This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian. The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Can British politicians legally order the killing of their own citizens? It was a question that demanded answers this week as the Prime Minister revealed the dispatch of two British jihadis and a further hit list of Islamic State drone targets in Syria. Also this week, under pressure to respond to Europe's growing refugee crisis, David Cameron tells Parliament that Britain will give asylum to 20,000 Syrians, but only over 5 years. And to round off a busy return to Westminster politics, the government suffers its first defeat, ominously, some would say, on the European referendum. Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnists Raphael Baer and Polly Toynbee, and our Home Affairs editor, Alan Travis. A warm welcome to you all. It was, David Cameron said, an act of self-defence. Riyad Khan from Cardiff and Rahul Amin from Aberdeen were killed last month by a British drone strike in the Syrian city of Raqqa. Khan, the primary target, was said to have been plotting to commit barbaric acts in the UK, and Cameron said he would not hesitate to act again if the chance arose. Raphael Baer, not many people may mourn these deaths, at least not many people who didn't know these two young men personally, but legally and morally and politically, is a worrying precedent being set by this?
Well, it's terribly complicated in that sense, because we rely entirely on essentially the assertions of the Prime Minister that the case is as open and shut as he says it is. And so if you sort of start from the presumption that everything the Prime Minister says and everything the intelligence agencies have been saying to him is entirely true and reliable, which is a massive presumption, then, you know, an attack was imminent. These are people who had basically chosen to relinquish their Britishness, join a really appalling, vicious group of people who are dedicated to the destruction of you, me, this building, and everything it represents. And therefore, you can understand why most people would think, well, what exactly is the problem here? You found a mechanism to take them out, and that seems actually quite a rational thing to do. And I have some sympathy with that view. But the problem is, a lot of people will say, well, intelligence agencies and prime ministerial words are not as kind of reliable an authority for a lot of people as they might be for the prime minister and the intelligence agencies themselves. So this sort of assertion that it's legal and self-defense and entirely legitimate just doesn't have enough currency in a proper constitutional democracy. You know, you really need some other mechanism to persuade skeptical people that this is legal. Whether or not it's moral is contingent on that, because unless you have the evidence that it is self-defense, then the moral thing becomes subordinate slightly to the legal thing. But we shouldn't ignore the fact that I think most people, won't see a problem with this.
I mean, Alan, the human rights groups are starting on their legal challenge, and I guess this, Raph's right, it's not right first and foremost to think of this as a legal issue, but whether you're looking at it legally, morally, or politically, the all-important question is this thing, imminence. Was there an imminent attack? Now, there are hints, aren't there, that this was about a bomb planned for the VJ Day parade, and that's already in the past. So could there have been an imminent threat?
I think the fact that there will be a human rights, there will be a challenge in court, is absolutely essential and will be interesting. And I'm sure that the legal basis of the Attorney General's advice to the Prime Minister on the legality of these strikes will have been drafted in the full knowledge that it, whilst it won't be disclosed in substance, it won't be disclosed in detail, it will be tested in court at some point, whether it's weeks or months later.
So would that be in a closed session?
Well, the question of what material is given before the judge, put before the judge, that intelligence information could well be within a closed session indeed. But it has to be then, it does have to be tested by a judge. In that sense, we have one check there. It's not a complete blank check written by the Prime Minister and the security services in terms of the nature of that. There will be some kind of judicial check on it, albeit a limited one.
Polly put together the kind of trust me, the Middle East, and questions about the Attorney General and his legal advice. Echoes of Iraq?
Absolutely. I don't think anybody is in a mood to trust governments or secret services. to tell you the truth, and you have to drag it out of them. Years later, we haven't even got the Chilcot report yet. However, I do think, as Raphael said, that there is a sort of instinctive, well, thank God we've got these people who might well be coming back here and kill us all. They've joined a death cult. They've taken leave of their senses and joined what's probably one of the nastiest death cults that's been certainly in our lifetimes around this table, and would wish us every ill imaginable. But there is something that really does alarm me about the idea that we can send out drones and pick off British citizens, perhaps makes it more painful, that we think are going against the law or against our interests, wherever they might be. I mean, we're going to start doing it in the sort of Costa del Sol or anywhere where there are criminals or people seeking refugees. Belfast, what about Northern Cyprus? There are all sorts of places where drones could take out people who are escaping our justice.
Raphael, you wrote a thought-provoking column this week comparing it with the death penalty, which I take it everyone in Guardian Towers is against. But without this imminence business, this is a kind of wham-bam, thank you, Cam, punishment, really, isn't it? Rather than a kind of equivalent to a policeman shooting someone in the street.
Well, the other element to that is that also, and I mean, part of the comparison I was drawing was treason, the death penalty for treason in wartime. And I think the defence of this action, part of it would be these people aren't actually criminals who you'd like to, you know, if you could get a warrant and go and pick them off the Costa del Sol, you'd bring them back here and put them on trial. These are enemy combatants, and this is, you know, liberals in the US have grappled with this important concept of, you know, in the expansion of drone use over there, which is obviously way further advanced than it is from the UK. But as I say, I suppose if the argument is these people have actually joined essentially an army that is explicitly hostile to the British state, and they are carrying arms in the pursuit of that agenda, that's a military context, and that's slightly different to whether or not you think someone's a criminal and you'd really like to bag them, but unfortunately they're far away, and so the drone's more convenient. On the politics of it, I think the Prime Minister has to be very careful. He is naturally complacent about his own authority and his own sense of his self-righteous reflection of his own ability to get these judgments right, and that people just ought to trust him because he's that kind of chap. Mm. The announcement of this on Monday, bundled up with a parliamentary statement on the refugee crisis, seemed to sort of designed to confuse and muddy the situation. I mean, they're two very, very different things, and I'm sure it was convenient for him to only come to the House once and make the two statements at the same time. But if we are going to go down this route, it has to have the legitimacy and the transparency, insofar as is possible with anything to do with the security services, right sort of front-loaded at the beginning. And yet here, right front-loaded at the beginning, he does it in this slightly mulchy, muddy, there's nothing really to see here, move along now kind of way. And again, that's something that makes me a bit uncomfortable.
I mean, he could, Alan, on the refugee point, he could have got Theresa May to explain what was happening on that front. It looked to me like maybe he wanted to merge these two subjects.
Oh, I think it was a straightforward bit of nasty politics. He knew he was on a complete hook as far as his response to the refugee crisis was coming along. And he's the one thing that the news media need to get him off such a hook is a bit of breaking news. And this was a genuine bit of breaking news that no organisation worth its salt could afford to ignore. The fact.
So he kept up his sleeve for several weeks.
Quite possibly, just about argue that it was the first day back for the Commons and the reporting on the Commons. But, I mean, it worked in those terms. And to that extent, it was a piece of news media management, but one which the news media were not that resistant to.
On the substance of the refugee announcement, 20,000, it sounded like a big number, turned out to be smaller on inspection because it's over 5 years, Alan. Why do you say he was on a hook? Why couldn't he say, well, I've taken a kind of middle course here?
People often say that refugees bring out the best in people and the worst in politicians. And without doubt, the British government was under serious pressure after the publication of the picture of the three-year-old boy dying on the beach, the Kurdish boy from Syria, Aylin. And there was a huge wave through the public opinion that something must be done. I think what we saw in his response and what we've seen in Cameron's response has been very slow on refugees in the last 2 years now. It's slow when the UNHCR first appealed for refugees to be taken, 100,000 in January last year, and he first set up this vulnerable persons relocation scheme in January last year. Only 216 have ever arrived under it. His reflection of how weak and bureaucratic, well, perhaps the most bureaucratic resettlement scheme on the face of the planet. Why? Because, well, we've had a glimpse of what life outside the European Union is going to be for Britain here, how weak, how, what a small, pathetic response we can make on our own. He doesn't want to do any more than 4,000 a year. In actual fact, 4,000 a year for 5 years is exactly the same number as the number of Syrian refugees we've given refugee status to in the last 5 years. So it's mainly means to keep things going at the same rate. It's compared to...
Can I just check, do we trust him? Well, like you said, this scheme before that you've said only brought in a total of 200-odd people was meant to bring in a few more than that, wasn't it? Is this 20,000 credible, or is it going to end up not even fulfilling that?
Oh, I think he'll manage to find the UNHCR. It's a complicated scheme. The UNHCR nominates candidates in the camps. British officials then make a final decision on who should be regarded as the most vulnerable. And already a debate has broken out in the Tory party as to who should be given the most priority. Within that, there's a Tory right who, Lord Carey, Lord Green of Migration Watch, who think that Christians should be given... biggest priority there. Muslims perhaps should be looked after by Saudi Arabia and the Arab states. There's already a debate going, pressure within inside the Tory party over who is the most vulnerable. And on the other side, you have to have councils who are willing to take and host people for 5 years and provide all the facilities necessary. The previous scheme, the scheme as it started, was fatally flawed from the beginning because the Home Office would only guarantee funding for 1 year, and no council was willing to take refugees for 5 years in the knowledge that they would only get Whitehall funding for 1 year to meet all their needs. Manchester, Sheffield, Glasgow all offered to take people under the refugees in much bigger numbers in the last 12 months, all turned around and said, I'm sorry, we can't do it on the basis of 1 year only funding. We're again seeing overseas aid being offered, but only for 1 year. Under the overseas aid rules, you can only use the overseas aid budget to fund the reception of refugees, and that only lasts the first 12 months. You can't keep using it for beyond that. So we're back in the situation with Theresa May, Greca, the Community Secretary, trying to negotiate now with the councils, local authorities in the wings. The Home Office are sort of panicking, beginning to think of ways of appealing to the public to take in individuals from the refuge to meet the quote, to meet the 4,000 in their own homes. That also has complications because if you bring over people who are disabled, the most vulnerable, they need a lot of looking after. And whilst the public may be willing to take in individual refugees, they're not necessarily have got the right skills to look after the most vulnerable people.
And town halls at the moment, Polly, are not in a good condition to take this on. There's some politics, isn't there, in opening up the DFID budget, even if that's allowable in the first year?
Luckily, the rules about international aid are very strict, as Alan says. And so you've got to be careful how much you can shift it. In the past, they've wanted to shift some of it into the defence budget. There are all kinds of people having, departments having a look at it, saying, here's a protected zone of money. Couldn't we use it for something else? But I don't think they can break those rules, and they may fudge it a little bit around the edges, but people will be watching like anything. I think already you're going to find that some very, very poor parts of the world with very good projects going on, funded by that aid budget, will have their money yanked out quickly, put into refugee-type schemes, and that will be a huge loss because, on the whole, aid only really works over any period of time with rational projects with a long time scale.
What's the sense here, Raf, of the politics of the refugee issue? As Alan says, there was clearly a big move in the public mood with those dreadful pictures a week or two ago. But are the Conservatives still worried about UKIP?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think Alan made a very good point in relation to the European frame. I think what we saw was a sort of muscle memory on the part of the Prime Minister and the Tory leadership. They're so used to seeing anything connected to migration through this lens of how will it play with people who are essentially hostile to any kind of migration, and particularly to the European Union. And some of the difficulty around the participating in a wider European scheme is that the headline that says, hang on, Juncker is basically dictating our immigration policy. We've surrendered control of the borders yet again to the European Union. All this sort of stuff. Those headlines could write themselves very easily. And therefore, there was this sort of sense that the Prime Minister was wrong-footed when it turned out that this was a story about humanitarian catastrophe and compassion, and sort of they as it were, parked it in the wrong part of their political brain.
How utterly short-sighted. At the same time, he's going round, cap in hand, round Europe, asking them for favours to get him off the hook, to try and get something for his renegotiation in time for the referendum. And how can he look in the eye the likes of Germany and France and Greece and Italy, particularly Greece and Italy, you know, poorer countries in a desperate state with so many refugees arriving, and say, no, we're not going to take any of them, but by the way, will you please give me these things I want, you know, no...
Absolutely. I mean, this is the story of the last 2 or 3 years for David Cameron's diplomacy. He seems to have a very limited grasp of actually the way that European diplomacy is supposed to work, and that there's give and take, and everyone compromises a little bit. And
we'll come back to Europe in a second, but we shouldn't leave the possibility of airstrikes, which is suddenly back on the agenda. Is that about something that's going on in the ground? A few months ago, they were still sounding very nervous about reopening the question. They were defeated 2 years ago on airstrikes in Syria. Has something changed on the ground in Syria, or is this again about politics and what's going on in Labour, the fact they want to bring it back to the House now?
Clearly, you get a very strong sense that both Prime Minister and the Chancellor and everyone essentially at the top of the Conservative Party who wanted to act in Syria 2 years ago feel that the outcome of that was bad, and that it was bad for Britain's standing in the world, and it's something they want to revisit. I mean, obviously, it's sort of bizarre to think that you were talking about strikes against Assad's regime, now you're talking about strikes against ISIS. So, you know, these are actually different sides in the civil war. So that when the Prime Minister says, well, the goal is to have a Syria without Assad or ISIS, this is the most extraordinary utopian assertion you can imagine. I mean, obviously, we'd love a world full of peace and harmony, but what is your practical application of policy on the ground to achieve that? It's absolutely, don't seem to have any idea. But it is also clear that if it's felt that there are enough Labour MPs who, you know, anticipating possibly a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour Party, who will feel absolutely no loyalty to that leadership at all, and themselves were pretty unhappy with the way that vote went 2 years ago, would vote with the government, then Cameron would put it before the House in the blink of an eye.
Alan?
In Cameron's defence, in a sense, in that he's not the first Conservative Prime Minister who's been caught in this bind between fears about migration on the one hand and trying to do the right thing by refugees on the other, and not properly separating out the two. Edward Heath, much praise this week for his response to the Ugandan Asian crisis only 2 years after Enoch Powell's River of Blood speech. I mean, the cabinet papers do show that he did order a hunt around every outpost of the British Empire, asking them to take the Ugandan Asians before he was willing to bring them to Britain. I think only the Falklands Islands turned around and said, yes, please send us some farmers.
There were huge campaigns.
But Margaret Thatcher, again, Margaret Thatcher in the early 1979, being faced with the prospect of 10,000 Vietnamese boat people, she feared there'd be riots on the streets if they were given council housing. It took Peter Carrington and Willie Whitelaw to show her their post bags that Conservatives up and down the country wanted her to do the right thing by the Vietnamese boat people, and she did in the end. So Cameron's not the first Conservative Prime Minister to find himself in this particular bind.
And does that make you think he might get there in the end?
I think he does get there in the end, but only, unfortunately, in this case, the scale of his response is puny compared to the scale of the crisis.
But muddying it up with the war question, I think those Labour MPs, John Woodcock and others, who were busy saying, oh, well, this time, you know, we really might go out and vote for war, they've got to think very carefully, because after all, if they're regretting, as Raf said, if they're regretting last time not fighting on one side, and a couple of years yet later they now want to fight on the other side, they're going to have to explain that. They're going to have to explain what good it does, because already you've got the Americans, the Canadians, the Qataris and others bombing like mad and not getting anywhere much in terms of holding ISIS back. So what is our extra contribution? Is it just to say, we're there, we're one of you?
There's a war, we want a part of it.
There's a war, we want a part of it, that's what we're good at. And you look at the rest of Europe and you say, why is it that other countries don't always feel they have to get in there? The moment they see a fight, they've got to get in there and be there too. They've got to explain what the particular purpose, what particular addition we bring to this particular war party.
In fairness, the French are now agitating. François Hollande has said that some sort of strike against ISIS is on his agenda too. Although that plays exactly back into this sense, and I don't want to be too cynical about it because these are very difficult decisions for a prime minister. But you do get the feeling there is this strong sense that Britain is UN Security Council permanent member, proper country, that it's somehow just sort of embarrassing that we can't step up and just do something here. And the idea that the French might be doing it, as the other nuclear power in Europe, and we're not. There is a strange kind of status kudos thing on the international stage, but that feeds into these
decisions. Isn't there a divide that cuts right across parties, which is that there's people who see it as an issue of pride, national pride, and then there's more pragmatic types in the Conservative benches, as well as Labour, who are saying, well, how's it going to help? And isn't it right that the war party have got a difficulty until they can explain how it's going to help bring a resolution in Syria, that they've got their work cut out?
Well, the counter-argument is doing nothing has really obviously failed very, very badly. So there is also a burden of proof on the sort of stop the war side of the argument, both uppercase and lowercase, to say, well, what exactly, now 2, 3, 5 years into this, what exactly is your, well, let's just turn our backs on this because it's too complicated, answer to helping refugees get back to Syria or removing Assad or dealing with ISIS. None of those things are dealt with by the anti-war party either. So that argument can go both ways.
But Cameron speaks from a world of fantasy, as if we controlled the world. It's quite extraordinary to hear him saying, well, what we're going to do is we're going to get in there and do diplomacy. We're going to say Assad can stay for 6 months and then he'll go and then there'll be some sort of new unspecified government. You think, well, hang on a minute. this is the British contribution, is it? Well, of course there should be ongoing efforts at every kind of diplomacy, but it feeds our fantasy of ourselves as this great world power, and it's time we stop doing that.
Well, we are a world power.
Let's just turn very briefly to the subject that David Cameron didn't want us to discuss this week, which was his first parliamentary defeat of the new session, which came on the question of the referendum bill and I think the Purdah rules. Alan, you've watched these things for a time. Does it feel like Maastricht all over again?
The bastards, you mean?
Yeah.
I don't think so, really, not in the same kind of way. I mean, the EU referendum is the backdrop to this parliament. There'll be a drumbeat against it. I think the outcome of the Labour leadership election will, in some ways, will have a consequence and impact on the Tory party, which perhaps hasn't been quite as played out and as put at the forefront of the debate as it might do, which is once you take away the discipline on a party that they might lose the next election. And I think a lot of Conservative MPs will greet the Labour Party leadership result with the belief that they have got the next election in the bag. Then that creates all merry hell on the backbenches because you've no longer got them the key disciplinary whip against them. In that sense, we could see a repeat of Maastricht. I think most of the Maastricht rebels are written off the 1992 general election, wrongly as it turned out in the case of John Major. But I think it will be all to play for. And so it's just going to be guerrilla warfare between now and the referendum next year.
It's pretty early to start losing votes. But there again, Raf, the majority was only 12, wasn't it?
Well, yes. And the other interesting thing about this is it testifies to the fact that the Conservative anti-EU Get Out Brigade are very well organised, but also they have a very clear strategy, and it's been unfolding over a number of years, which is not to run at the Prime Minister head on and say, look, we just want out. It's as simple as that. Give us what we want. Because when they do that, the Prime Minister is forced to stand up to them and say, no, well, actually, I don't think that's the right decision for the UK. They don't want to have that argument. What the strategy has always been to ratchet the Prime Minister a little bit at a time, chip away at his authority, because when they sort of shove him a little bit, then he takes a step backwards. And you see, this is exactly what's happened here with the Purdah thing. I'm sure they have very good principled reasons why they didn't like what was being tabled, but also they found a way to sort of get around the side of the Prime Minister, hurt him a little bit. And as soon as it's done, they're already saying, well, there'll be another one at conference. They want to push him on the renegotiation. Ultimately, these are people who just want to leave the European Union. They are deferring the moment when they declare that that's exactly what they want. But in the meantime, they have a strategy for undermining the Prime Minister, making his life harder. And it works. And the Prime Minister falls for it every single time. And at some stage, he just has to stand up and say, you're playing games. I'm talking about the future of the country. I want in. And he hasn't got the guts to do it.
Finally, Polly, I mean, this is going to run and run, isn't it?
It's going to run and run. It's going to be the story of this Parliament. It'll be the story of Cameron's legacy. If he pulls it off, we stay in. That's OK. If he doesn't, and it's increasingly looking as if he might not, I'm for the first time really frightened. He loses not just little England out of Europe, but little England and no Scotland anymore.
Well, that's your lot. My thanks to Polly, to Raphael and to Alan. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.